This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, and it is The Record. I'm Bill Radke with the Mayor of Seattle, Ed Murray. Welcome.
Thanks for having me back on.
Mayor Murray's going to take your phone calls now at 206-543-5869, 206-543-KUOW. Why does he do what he does? What do you want from him? Ask him yourself. Seattle's mayor's on the line for you, 543-KUOW. You're recently back from Mexico City. What's Mexico City got to do with Seattle?
There were cities, mayors from around the world who met on the environment. We're part of an international organization, and the American mayors who were there recommitted that regardless of what the new administration does, we are committed to the Paris agreements. And we believe that we can keep, if the cities in this country keep their own commitments and step up our own efforts, that we can keep this country on course to those commitments.
Let's talk about Trump a little bit. By the way, we're also on Twitter, at KUOW, taking your questions. What is your number one realistic concern about a President Trump?
Well, obviously, I don't know where to begin. I don't think there's just one. There's a bunch of number ones. Obviously, the issue of immigration, the issue of what happens with the economy, his tax cut ideas, all these could have a fairly detrimental effect on average people everywhere, including the city. I'm particularly maybe concerned about a new Justice Department and a new Attorney General stepping back from the national efforts to reform our police departments. Seattle's made huge progress. We're now one of the cities that is leading on how you get reform done. But I think if the federal government steps back, if the Justice Department steps back, I think it could lead to real tragedy and potentially violence.
What would be the top example of the kind of tragedy you're having in mind?
Well, we have some pretty significant issues in this country, and the intersection of guns. There's so many guns in this nation, and how have police react to that, but also the intersection of race and policing. And it is a constant and will always be an ongoing effort to understand our communities, to understand what's the best technique to police. And we have police departments around this country that are not like ours, that don't have the training our department now has. And I think that could lead to yet more African Americans being shot in situations that are questionable, leading to a backlash from communities that are angry. And I don't think that's the way for us to go forward.
We'll probably get back to the president-elect. I do want to ask you, it's cold. It's going to get colder, sub-freezing this weekend, and a lot of us are thinking about folks here with no place to live.
Right.
You've been planning a new 24-hour shelter with showers and laundromat and food and staffers that help people navigate all the services they can get. And this week your office said it won't open that navigation center by the end of the year because, if I understood it right, the city is still choosing where it's going to go. So why is it so hard to site a shelter when you've given yourself emergency powers?
I think it's important to remember that we've increased resources 40% in the time I've been mayor. We've increased shelter capacity significantly. The largest increase in one time in the city's history. The navigation center isn't an issue of us deciding not to open it up. You know, we don't have a bunch of buildings out there.
Right.
We're working with a nonprofit and private individuals who have buildings that we would like to use for this navigation center. We need to get their agreement, and then we need to get a lot of facilities in there, showers and bathrooms and other hygiene things. There aren't a lot of buildings sitting out there that have that capacity. It's taking longer than I want, but I have to, again, remind people we've taken a lot of effort to provide shelter, and we'll take more efforts to create interim measures to get people what they need. But I also just want to take a moment to remind people that I am hearing from mayors in Southwest Washington, in east of Lake Washington, in eastern Washington, on the Pacific Coast, and they're all struggling with the same thing, a growing homeless population, encampments in places that are not good for the city or for the people who are homeless. And I think it's important for people in Seattle to remember that this isn't some failure on our part. This is a bigger problem. I was just with West Coast mayors from major cities on Monday. And again, our problem is bad. Their problem in many cases is worse. And we're all struggling with what is a national epidemic. If we can't deal with addiction, if we can't deal with mental illness, if we can't deal with affordable housing on the national and state levels, then cities individually by themselves will not be able to solve this problem.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray with us, with you, because we are opening our phone lines for some questions, 206-543-5869, 543-KUOW, and of course we're on Twitter, at KUOW. The city has authorized 7 homeless encampments. 3 of them are open, Ballard, Interbay, Rainier Valley. 3 of them are coming, Georgetown, near Greenwood, near White Center, and then another one, I believe. And you said you don't like opening these tent and tiny house camps. Is the plan to close them at some point?
So, you know, what I have said is they are an answer to nothing except a safer place to sleep, a somewhat safer place, and a somewhat warmer place. But they are not an answer to move people into permanent housing. And it's an emergency measure because we are in a crisis, but we do need to refocus our resources not simply on shelters, but moving people quickly out of shelters into permanent housing. We spend too much of our money and too much of our time on the part of the system that doesn't actually move people into housing. And so we have a series of proposals to start shifting our funding to rapidly get people out of shelters and rapidly get them either the treatment or the housing that they need.
One more question on homelessness. A lot of people listening to you right now want to help. What do you suggest they do?
So there's a lot that folks can do. First of all, we work with our nonprofit partners. So there are numerous, and I'm not going to start listing them off, but they're
but, you know, I give out change and granola bars. I assume the city can buy sleeping bags more cheaply than I can. What do I help?
First of all, I think connecting with those nonprofits that are our partners that create the services for homeless. Let me just name one since we're in the U District. Let me name a few. Teen Feed, homeless youth that feeds teenagers right a block away from us. Roots, which gives shelter right about 2 blocks away from us here in the U District. Roots gives shelter to homeless youth, as well as Youth Care, which is basically at the bottom of Capitol Hill. There's one area for people to think about. Working with our school district for little kids who were with their families who are homeless, we've made a commitment that this city should have no children, school-age children, who are homeless a year from now. So connecting with those organizations, other organizations, the answer really is with our nonprofits for us to partner with them.
Our phone number is 543-5869 in area code 206. And Jerry is on the line from West Seattle. Jerry, what's your question for Mayor Ed Murray?
Well, I was wondering if he thinks that the new rental laws in Seattle are going to help at all. Because in my situation, I run a trust, and the family members I had in the house, I couldn't afford to bring that house up to the quality when I took it over that it would be legally rentable. So I had to sell it to a developer that's going to build 3 houses on it now, and that's displaced roughly 10 people because they let a few people couch surf on their property. So what I'm kind of wondering is, you know, like, what I agree with what he said. I've lived in Seattle my whole life. There's a problem with that. You know, you have to bring people into real housing and actually bring up the quality of their life. They have to be able to get jobs. I've taken these people into my own house temporarily till I can actually give them money.
And what's your question, Jerry?
He really got at what I thought was a question. He had a house. He didn't have the funds to or a building, it sounds like. He didn't have the sources to renovate that and keep it affordable. We're actually asking the state legislature to give us a tax credit that we could go to a developer or to a building owner like him and say, we will we'll give you a tax credit if you keep some of those units affordable, thus making it much cheaper to renovate a property. Preserving places like he mentioned is as important as our significant expansion of new housing.
So he had that, Jerry had that home, that unit in the private sector. And I want to talk a little about the city and the private sector. Do you ever think, maybe we're over-regulating or over-taxing? Sometimes people complain about there's wages and scheduling and paid leave and telling landlords how they can charge. How do you feel?
Well, first of all, this is a city that is still has fewer taxes than many of the cities around us. And I mean like next door to us. So there's a bit of a myth out there around the issue of affordability. You know, the private sector is our partner in developing affordable housing. Part of the HALA agreement is that in our urban villages, they can have basically an extra floor, but they will build affordable units, not the government and not our nonprofits, but that the private sector also needs to provide them. I think that we need to be very careful. If we pile too much onto landlords, it will only go on to the renter. So while we need to be responsible and get them to be up to code, to be reasonable with renters, we also have to be careful that we don't go too far.
Councilmember Tim Burgess says he won't run again. People call him a moderate or a conservative or the grown-up on the council. What do you want from that new council member? More progressive, more moderate?
So if Tim Burgess had been in the legislature, he would have been a left liberal Democrat.
Right.
Which he is.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also somebody who is practical. And so I don't think it's the person's ideology I care about, because Seattle is going to elect a progressive, period. The question is, are we going to elect a progressive who's also pragmatic, who understands you can't just pass ideology, you have to work in the real world with real people, in real entities, and find a way through. You know, one of the problems we're having at the national level, one of the things we're seeing with our new president-elect and the people who supported him, is an unwillingness to compromise. Progressives can't go there, too.
We're talking with Seattle Mayor Ed Murray, and you're talking to him at 206-543-5869. Julian in Capitol Hill, what's your question for the mayor? Julian, still with us?
Hello. My question for Mayor Murray is, what city resources are you prepared to deploy to fight Trump's immigration policies? And if ICE attempts to detain our immigrant neighbors, would you order Seattle police to oppose them?
That's a really good question, and I said this the morning after the election. We will remain the same city we are. We will support people here who are undocumented, like the 13-year-olds I met with the day after the election, who are either immigrants or undocumented. These are folks who are neighbors. These kids, their parents are working in jobs that often Americans won't take, and they're paying taxes.
But you can't promise anyone they're safe from federal immigration.
But let me tell you what I can do to get to his question. It is legal for us not to cooperate, and so we will not cooperate. We do not cooperate. We will not cooperate. Our fire department does not ask what your documentation is. If you have a medical emergency or a fire, we want undocumented folks to call the police if they're victims of domestic violence. We are willing to go to the courts to fight any attempt to remove people from our city. We're looking at additional funding to pay for that defense, should it become necessary. And again, you know, these people are – these immigrants, regardless of their documentation, are one of the ways that we create a vital city. Cities in this country have always based on immigrants, and there's usually always been a question around documentation.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray talking with you. Talking about a president-elect, among other things. Are you going to upzone single-family neighborhoods in Seattle?
So the HALA agreement, which is there, is an upzone of our urban villages and urban cores. Our single-family neighborhoods that are zoned single-family neighborhoods will remain zoned single-family neighborhoods. I know there's a lot of myths and a lot of fear, but if we want to talk about an affordable city, then we do need to grow some density in our urban villages. Otherwise, we'll find ourselves basically in the situation San Francisco is in when they basically decided to cap growth.
Do you think we can avoid that situation without upzoning single-family neighborhoods?
I think
we have so many of them in Seattle.
I think that we can. I mean, I really think that we can. Our urban villages are still fairly low-dense compared to many cities. So I think the capacity is there. And it is really an issue of a willingness on the part of everybody to step back from, oh, the mayor is going to plow down your neighborhoods, and spend a little more time talking about how we create an affordable city. And I think we'll all come to an agreement that we can have great single-family neighborhoods and have density in our urban villages as well.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray on the line, 543-KUOW. And I want to ask about the new proposed sports arena, Soto or Key Arena?
So, you know, I'm willing to work with anybody who can bring us a team. And so far, what we've heard from Chris Hansen, he's really liked that arena, but he himself is not going to bring us a team. So we have several questions we need to sort out here. One is, the city has a resource that the taxpayers are going to pay for one way or the other, and that's Key Arena. Is that a possibility? And again, is someone going to actually bring us a team? If that doesn't work, Soto is still an option. But again, someone is going to have to identify who's going to actually pay to bring us a team, I think, for me to be able to get anything through council. I think the idea that it might happen is probably not going to be enough to get council there.
206-543-5869, 543-KUOW. Let's talk a little politics. How should Democrats, in your opinion, win back white working-class voters in places like Mason County and Western Washington? They voted for Obama in 2012 and then flipped to Trump.
Well, it's a really important question. And, you know, one of the things I don't think we did a good job of talking about in this campaign, let's just talk about the issue of housing affordability. Hopefully people have seen or will read the book Evicted by Matthew Desmond. You know, families are being destroyed around this country because of a housing affordability crisis. It doesn't stop at the city borders of Seattle. There's a housing affordability crisis in Grays Harbor County. There's one throughout this country. Are we willing to talk about that? The other issue is the issue of wages. You know, Seattle's actually led the nation on that, but did we really talk about that enough? I think the third thing that particularly Seattle Democrats have to focus on is sometimes the way we talk about things in rural Washington state feels a little evangelical and preachy.
Example, please.
Well, I think sometimes we think we have the religion when it comes to politics. And I think we have the exact same values and interests of folks who are suffering in Grays Harbor County or Mason County. But sometimes the language we use feels to them accusatory and like we're not hearing them. And we need to hear them. We care about poverty. And folks in this state, not just in this city, are hurting. And we have to find a way to reach out and listen to them and not just feel like we have the answers that they need to adopt.
Our reporters do tell us they go way outside Seattle and someone finds out that we're from Seattle and they'll say, well, I guess I won't hold that against you. There's a lot of eye-rolling and political correct complaining when it comes to Seattle,
yeah,
this town, in this state.
There is, and that's a natural tension between any big city and any the rest of the state, of any state. But I do think that there's something there about you know, I hear it when I go to Grays Harbor County, where I was born and my family immigrated to.
I didn't know that.
I grew up in Seattle, but I was actually born there. But what I hear from folks is kind of, I mean, they're kind of wondering what I'm doing. You know, Mayor of Seattle.
Right. KUOW, taking calls, 543-KUOW. Lee is in North Seattle. Lee, what's your question for Mayor Murray?
Hi, I'm president of the Resident Action Council of Seattle Housing Authority. The incoming Trump administration has made it clear it will take HUD funding from sanctuary cities. Where is funding going to come from to maintain housing affordability for the 16,000 people I represent?
Well, first of all, the Seattle Housing Authority is a federally funded agency, and I think we need to point that out. It's not actually a city entity. It has a great leader in Andrew Lofton. I think it's important to remember that the courts have said that the federal government can't just simply arbitrarily cut funding because you're doing something. So in this case, I could see if we do not cooperate on deporting people, that they could have a legal right to cut funding that they give us for the police department. But legally, there isn't a nexus between affordable housing and deporting people who are not here legally. So our first thing is to fight it in the courts. And I think we need to be more concerned not about that the Seattle Housing Authority and housing authorities around the nation are going to lose money because it stands on immigration, but that they're going to lose money because this new president is going to do dramatic tax cuts. He cuts that amount of money, it means places like housing authorities are going to hurt. So we need to figure out how we work with our federal delegation to prevent that from happening.
Speaking of housing, we have a question from a listener on Twitter where we are at KUOW. Leschi Elementary has 70 homeless kids, over double than last year, says the questioner. What are you going to do to provide housing is the question.
Sure. So I launched a program with the school district that is identifying homeless school kids and getting them into shelter. The city has always had, or at least over the last decade, has had school-age children who are homeless. So we're actually putting the services in the schools. And we've made a commitment by this time next year, we're going to have those kids not just in shelter, but in stabilized housing.
Another Twitter questioner asks, major cities with worse economies / some larger populations, Phoenix, Chicago, don't have our homeless issue. Are we learning from them?
So first of all, I think we have to ask ourselves, what is it about Seattle and San Francisco and, by the way, Vancouver, British Columbia, and Portland, Oregon? What's going on here that you see a significant rise in the West Coast? And I think that's a question that we're all asking ourselves. I hired some outside.
Is it especially happening in the West Coast?
Absolutely. The numbers in the West Coast are dramatically different than the rest of the country.
And it's not just moderate weather?
That includes Vancouver, British Columbia, a very different political, a very different safety net. So there's something here that we need to understand further. But I did ask people from the outside to come in and look at what the city does and how we spend our money on homelessness. And the recommendations were something I said earlier, that the city and county are too focused on the part of the system that doesn't get people out of homelessness. We always talk about shelters and we always talk about encampments. It's reprogramming that money towards those organizations that can show us through outcomes that they can rapidly move people into housing. That means, based on those recommendations, looking at other cities, some programs are going to have to be cut so that we can fund those programs that actually work. It is very, very hard to get Democratic city council members up and down the West Coast to vote to cut any human service program. But if we want to get to best practices and we want to move people out of housing, then we need to look at those reports that have told us you're doing it the wrong way.
Have you cut any of those underperforming agencies yet?
So we are in the process. That report came out in August. So we're in the process of setting up the competitive bid process that agencies can go through based on criteria that they have to meet. And that would hit our next budget next fall.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray taking your questions at 206-543-5869. That's 543-KUOW and on Twitter at KUOW. Last year, you set a 10-year goal, Mayor, of building and preserving 20,000 affordable housing units. How many have you created so far?
So I don't have the number off the top of my head, but, you know.
He's working without notes, by the way, this entire time.
And I should have that on the top of my head. I know that we are exceeding our at current levels, that we are exceeding our goal. And it's over 10 years. And again, when the housing affordability livability agenda is fully up, and that will be finally approved in its last pieces, hopefully by council later next year, we will create three times the number of affordable housing units we're creating today, which will make us literally number one or two in the nation in the number of units we are producing.
You're going to meet your 10-year goal.
We will meet our 10-year goal.
KUOW taking phone calls for Seattle Mayor Ed Murray, including Carl in Greenwood. Carl, welcome, and what's your question?
Yes, this regards salting of streets. If it gets a little bit cold and there's going to be some precip, most of the time the salt is deployed for no cause in the end. And it seems to me to be a little bit more logical to salt grades with a certain steepness and be ready to deploy sand in a light way on the more level streets. It's highly corrosive to cars, and there are some environmental impacts to throwing a lot of salt around, although I'm sure that has been looked at carefully. Any chance of getting a more sensible, logical strategy to use all this expensive equipment sparingly?
So one of the challenges for people who haven't lived here before and experienced our snow is we don't actually have a lot of expensive equipment because we actually don't have that many snowstorms. But what we try and use
the occasional snowstorm can bring a mayor low.
Right. Yeah. You know that. Yeah. I somehow don't think that is ever an issue by itself.
Mm.
But we do salt, and we have found when the city didn't salt, it was pretty disastrous. We identify, you know, those major routes throughout the city, particularly ones that are related to bus or are on steep grades, that we salt before it freezes because it helps keep the roads from getting slick. This is a public safety issue. It's also an economic issue. If we were to have a big snowstorm right now, it would have a significant impact negatively on our economy, especially during the holiday season when people shop and we are a sales tax dependent state and city. So, and as a storm would increase, a snowstorm and freezing would increase, we will increase the salting, and we think we're doing it in an appropriate way. There is some environmental impacts, and there is some corrosiveness to cars. But again, there are other things we need to weigh that against. Injuries, people being injured in accidents, our economy, our ability to function as a city.
I saw somewhere someone scoffing at the idea of Seattle plowing bike lanes. What's that about?
But, you know, I mean, bike lanes are like on the street. So, you know, we plow streets.
Yeah.
So, and we don't plow all.
You're not buying special skinny plows to go between barriers and the end of the lane.
Not that I've seen.
Okay.
So.
Okay, let's take another phone call for Seattle Mayor Ed Murray from Michael in Seattle. Michael, what's your question?
Hello, my question is, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, hello, my question is the growing segregation that we've seen in Seattle, and do you have any plans to address this disparity that, I mean, it's continuously growing. I grew up in Seattle, I grew up in Leschine in the Central District, and essentially it's turned a completely different color, so how do you plan to address that?
That's a really good question, and Seattle has a history of housing policies in past decades that led to a more racially mixed south end and not a particularly one in the north end, although that is changing. We are one of the hearts of the HALA is to create affordable housing in our traditionally minority neighborhoods. But we're doing two other things. We're creating an equity fund that will allow us to build even more to preserve culture and to make sure that people of color who want to live in those neighborhoods can live in those neighborhoods. In addition, we're going to create some pretty high barriers for significant new development in the central area in Chinatown, to give you two examples, at the request of people who've lived in those neighborhoods for decades and decades, so that the rapid gentrification that we see in some of those neighborhoods won't be able to keep a pace.
We've been talking with Seattle's Mayor Ed Murray, who has a lot of other things to do, and we do want to let you get on to your busy day. Is there? There's a whole bunch of stuff I could have asked you about, didn't get to. Is there one thing that you would like me to ask you about, you want to talk about, that I haven't let you do?
Well, and I should know as a politician to have that question ready right away. I think that...
No, this has been such a perfect half hour.
Well, let me...
accomplished everything.
Let me give you... we've barely touched it. Let me give you an example of why people should feel good about this city. We are a fairly innovative city, and the caller asked about snow. So tonight we're going to have a hackathon on snow. And we're bringing together some of the brightest people to come up with ideas about how we get people information and how we get information as a city to manage our way through a snowstorm. That'll probably come up with some cool apps that'll be very helpful to people. But we've done that on homelessness, and we've done it on other issues. This is an innovative city that is committed to being a more equitable city. And so that's just a tiny thing. There are hundreds of things like that happening throughout your city government every day.
Jeff Bezos, not the only innovator in this town.
No, the people who live here and the people who work for the city of Seattle.
Seattle Mayor Ed Murray, taking your questions and mine, and we appreciate it. Will you come back again?
I'll come back. Invite me, I'll come.
Good. Thank you, Mayor. You're listening to The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle, news and information. We've got a lot to talk about this hour on The Record. Still to come, some African-Americans wondering, could I move back into my Seattle neighborhood? Comedians being funny about stuff you didn't expect them to be able to be funny about, and more. I want to talk for a moment just about travel, because you might be traveling for the holidays soon. Some of us are. That means the potential for adventure and for headaches, loved ones, and arguments. It can really go either way. In her new novel, Today Will Be Different, Seattle author Maria Semple lays out a theory of travel.
There's a phenomenon I call the helpless traveler. If you're traveling with someone who's confident, organized, and decisive, you become the helpless traveler. Are we there yet? My bags are too heavy. My feet are getting blisters. This isn't what I ordered. We've all been that person. But if the person you're traveling with is helpless, then you become the one able to decipher train schedules, spend 5 hours walking on marble museum floors without complaint, order fearlessly from foreign menus, and haggle with crooked cab drivers. Every person has it in him to be either the competent traveler or the helpless traveler. Because Joe is so clear-headed and sharp, I've been able to go through life as the helpless traveler. Which, now that I think about it, might not be such a good thing. It's a question for Joe.
Competent traveler, helpless traveler. This is true. How did this come to you, though?
This came to me the summer after I graduated from high school. I went to Europe with a Eurail pass, which I think all well-educated kids should do heading into college. And we had very little money. I was with my sister and our friend Kate Betts, and we were traveling around, and I found that either completely helpless and complaining and refusing to move, just kind of balking at times, just I'm not doing that, I don't have the energy. Or I would find several hours later even, I would be the one, rah, rah, come on, we can do this, one more museum. You know, nothing's going to keep us from getting climbing that hill to the top of the castle.
Would all of us rather be the helpless traveler?
I think that it's actually... it's an important role to be the helpless traveler and to assert yourself as the helpless traveler, because...
assert yourself as helpless.
Yes, and to say, okay, I'm not holding passports, I'm not holding plane tickets, I'm just going to show up where you tell me to show up. I actually think that that can be incredibly productive for the team, to say, I'm going to have no needs, no wants, no desires, no ideas about how to do things, and that's my role here in the team. When we get to the airport, getting on the plane, that saying, I'll do what you tell me, actually is very productive.
Then we don't have to wonder, I thought you were going to do that.
That's right.
That's removed.
It's so much easier. I mean, how many times are you standing there going, do you have the boarding passes? I gave you the boarding passes. Wait, no, you had them. I saw them in your hand. If one person is the one in charge and the other one just says, hey, I'm just chilling, I'm going to follow and have no point of view and no desires here, then that's actually a very important act.
Christmas season travel tips from best-selling novelist Maria Semple. Any final words as some of us get to change scenery here?
I think that the helpless traveler also applies when you're in family situations with in-laws. I have found that it's often helpful to apply the helpless traveler role around the dinner table. And you just think, I'll let other people pick the topics of conversation. I'll let it go where they want it to go. And I'm just going to sit back and not assert myself and not feel like I have to chime in when I'm offended or there's a political view I don't like, that maybe you can just let this Christmas dinner go where it's going to go and you will have nothing to do with steering it.
This is interesting. Helpless conversationalist. I mean, think about it. We could spin this out in so many scenarios.
That's right.
This is a new book, a self-help book. Maria Semple's first foray into self-help.
That's right. And to just let other people be the ones responsible for ruining Christmas.
Seattle novelist Maria Semple, author of the best-selling Where'd You Go, Bernadette, and her latest, Today Will Be Different, talking about how both the competent traveler and the helpless traveler lives within each of us. If you've got the chance to get out of here this season, happy travels. May the snow wait till your plane's in the air. May the SeaTac lines move like crazy. This is The Record. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle's Central District has been central to African Americans, historically, until a lot of them were priced out. But Paul Allen's Vulcan Real Estate Company is coming in, and on the site of the Red Apple Grocery, they're putting in a big apartment building that will include some affordable housing. That has some African Americans wondering, could I move back into the neighborhood? KUOW's Joshua McNichols has more.
Brianna Nelson has been following the project at community meetings.
It would be nice to live in this building if it is affordable.
Nelson teaches elementary school in the Renton School District. Right now she lives with her parents in South Seattle, but she'd like a place of her own. She has lots of ties to the Central District.
You said you grew up here?
Yes, I did.
She went to high school at Garfield, and a lot of her friends live here. Plus, there's the history. Once it was one of the few places blacks could live in Seattle.
And so because of that, I think it's created kind of a cultural hub for the African-American community in terms of community centers and festivals that have gone on.
Things have changed in the CD, and with these modern market-rate apartments, the neighborhood could change even more. Higher-income residents could end up spending more money on local businesses, and more people will have a place to live. Here's Vulcan's Ada Healy.
I'd actually like to point out there's not a single housing unit on the site today.
Vulcan gets a tax break for setting aside 1 in 5 of those apartments for people making as little as 65% of the average income in the region. That could help because the average income in the Central District is lower than other places. Nelson would have to qualify for one of those apartments. We consult a chart. We spread it out on the grass near the building site. Okay, how much do you make now?
Before taxes, $35,069.
In order to qualify for a studio, you have to earn less than $41,145. So you do. So you earn less than that. So
yes.
You qualify.
I do.
A discounted studio apartment would cost her $1,028 a month. She'd be paying about a third of her salary in rent, much less than many people in Seattle. Okay, so could you afford that?
Yes, I could afford that.
And there's more good news. Once you're in, the amount of money you earn can go up.
Right.
And you can stay there.
Oh, so rent would stay the same, even if I did make more later on.
Yeah, so if you got a raise, it's okay. You can stay there up to 150% of the amount that qualified you to get in.
Okay.
Nelson asks if she could take in a roommate to lower her costs even more. The chart says a roommate's extra income would disqualify her.
That's unfortunate.
Nelson starts to think about the rent a little differently.
30%. On paper, sorry, that doesn't seem like that much, but you have other things to factor into that cost as well. And I don't know, do they charge for parking here?
Parking is extra. So is internet. Then there's the student loans she's paying off. She wonders if she'll ever get ahead.
For teaching, it's hard to make more unless you get a master's or a doctorate. However, to get a master's or a doctorate, it costs to do so. And so once I get that, I'll be paying off more loans, which will put me in more debt.
Nelson's story is part of a larger trend. Minorities were moving out of the CD long before Paul Allen got there.
Head cow was out of the barn.
Ron Sims is a former King County executive and a former deputy HUD secretary under Obama.
Seattle is not going to be a diverse city. I mean, this, to be blunt, it's losing it. And the idea that somehow or other one development is going to curtail the loss of both racial and economic diversity, no, this town, this city, is not going to be diverse.
Sims says people of color have already moved on to other communities outside Seattle and even outside King County. In the Central District, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
If you were to guess who's responsible for looking out for wildlife, you probably wouldn't think of the Army. Well, it turns out more than 400 threatened or endangered species live on U.S. military land, almost four times more than in our national parks. So how do we protect animals in dangerous places? EarthFix reporter Katie Campbell has the next story in our series on the relationship between the military and the environment.
Biologist Adrian Wolf follows his GPS to a spot in a wide-open prairie. He searches the ground for something camouflaged in the dry grass.
So even though it might be right here, it's still so hard to find.
Then he spots it, a baby bird.
These birds are really cute. They look like grumpy little old men. They never peep at you when you hold them, but it's just the look that does it.
Wolf puts a tiny silver band on its leg. He's done this many times before, but his fingers still tremble.
Why? Because I have an endangered species and little life in my hand.
Only about 2,000 of these streaked horned larks are left on the planet. The prairies these birds rely on used to be the dominant landscape in this region. Now most of it has been taken over by agriculture and development. Wolf puts the hatchling back in its nest. He's trying to prevent these native Northwest songbirds from going extinct. But that's not an easy task, considering the dangers nearby. These larks happen to live on the Northwest's largest military base, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, or JBLM for short. It's just south of Tacoma.
Cease fire!
A few miles away, Lieutenant Colonel J.D. Williams is training his battalion.
All right, fellas, good job.
His job is to get soldiers ready for deployment.
Training's important. It increases our readiness, and readiness is our number one priority all across our Army. You can't just show up to remote locations and expect to know what you're doing. So you absolutely have to come out into environments like here at JBLM and utilize land and train.
Our mission!
one round, SRT, use PD.
Williams is leading artillery training. Firing each cannon takes a battery of 9 soldiers working with a remote team that spots the target and relays coordinates.
Red line 5-1, this Harris 5-3, over.
This kind of training requires a lot of land.
We need space so I can shoot something and I can observe it and I can test that system and make it better and make those soldiers better artillerymen.
The shell flies 6 miles through the air.
That's made 0 casualties, over.
That's no human casualties, but how do they know they aren't killing larks? The base is paying for biologists like Adrian Wolf from the Center for Natural Lands Management to gather GPS data on nest locations and track young birds when they're most vulnerable.
They just tucked into the veg on the right side. That's going to be really difficult. Oh, here's the other one. Sweet. That's it. We got it.
Base officials give this information to people like Lieutenant Colonel Williams so he can incorporate it into his training missions and make sure his soldiers don't bomb their nests.
They give us a graphic, you know, and so it's a military overlay, and we can go plot it on our map and say, stay out or avoid, or, hey, make sure you stay here and don't even think about coming over here. Okay, that's great. We're not going there. Acknowledge all. Yes, sir.
In some cases, they've actually made the nest locations part of their training by treating them like hospitals or schools, things they wouldn't want to destroy on a real-life battlefield. When a battalion is done with a training exercise, base officials inspect the land.
They check us out, and they ensure that we have done all that they told us to do, and that we didn't destroy the land or pollute the environment or harm any endangered or critical species.
With more than 90% of the region's prairies already destroyed, the prairies on JBLM have become one of the rarest types of landscapes in the United States. And Wolf says that's the key. The existence of the base has actually helped the lark by defending its prairies from development.
This is the irony about this place, is these military bases are the last refuges of fantastic habitat that's left really anywhere around the country.
It may seem impossible that larks would be able to coexist with artillery-firing soldiers, but living in such a dangerous place may be what has protected the streak-torn lark. At Joint Base Lewis-McChord, I'm Katie Campbell reporting.
That story is part of our new Earth Fix series, exploring the 75-year relationship between the U.S. military and the Pacific Northwest's environment. And you can find more photos and video and our interactive documentary at our website. Join us at KUOW.org. Now on KUOW, it's time for comedians talking about being depressed. Hilarious, right? John Moe is a writer, a radio host, former KUOW producer, and he's working on a new podcast called The Hilarious World of Depression, where he talks to comics about their struggles with mental health. John told me how he came up with the idea.
I used to host a radio show called Wits, and we brought in a lot of comedians to talk about, you know, to be on our show, to do sketches, to have a good time. And I noticed that a lot of the people that we were booking, as I watched clips of their act or read interviews about them, had dealt with clinical depression or were presently dealing with clinical depression. Some of them were talking about it in their acts, and some of them, as I got to know them as friends, had never talked about it in their acts, but were going through a really difficult time. And I thought, there seems to be a lot more of these people than in comedy than there are in the general population. And, you know, I had that kind of reporter like, huh? Let's find out more about that. So I started looking into it and started talking to people. And over time, as I started doing some of these interviews, I realized that what it was really about was explaining depression through the lens of comedians, kind of a spoonful of sugar thing. I mean, I always say, like, if you're looking at a topic and you can have a doctor from the Mayo Clinic explain it to you or Maria Bamford explain it to you, you're going to choose Maria.
That's an easy choice.
Yeah.
How much do these comedians share details with you about their depression and their journey?
The ones who agreed to talk to me, I was very specific about, you know, what I wanted to do. And in a lot of cases, I've known these people for a while. I was really excited to talk to Maria, and she told a story about when she had to cancel a show in order to check into an inpatient treatment center. And we'll listen to a little bit of that now.
The first time I went to the hospital, I was like, I'm just going to get in here 72 hours, just get my meds under control. My friend says I'm talking too fast. So I'm just going to just nip this in the bud and not bother anybody with it. Go to the hospital, get on a new medication, just try this new mood stabilizer thing, whatever. But still make my shows in Chicago next week, because that's a good... That's a really...
All I want is to have it all, yeah. All the time.
Is it? You know, it's just my brain.
So yeah, that's Maria Bamford. And we go to some pretty dark places, but Maria's one of the people who is doing so well now. I went and visited her with her husband of 1 year. I mean, he's like 45. He's not a one-year-old.
Okay.
She married.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for clearing it up.
And she's on a really good, well-matched set of meds that don't make her blissed out and don't make her all starry-eyed. They make her like, you know, the average person that you would meet over at Safeway.
Still funny.
Still so incredibly funny.
You're one of my favorite humorists, John, as you know.
Thank you.
So let me ask you, what do you know about depression personally?
I have dealt with depression since about the eighth grade, growing up in Federal Way, Washington. And it hit me just like a ton of bricks, and I didn't know what was happening. And I was disoriented by it. I was questioning everything about the world. I didn't see any point in moving through the world. And it just kicked me over and over and over again. And I kind of recovered such that it became a dull thrum through much of my life. And it stayed that way through a lot of my life. I find that it would crop up in moments of stress. I used to work at Amazon.com, which was a very stressful place. And leading up to some big launch or big event we were doing, I remember being on the bus and thinking, okay, here are the 12 things I got to get done today to hit this launch. I wish I could kill myself. Just as a passing thought.
It was on the list.
Yeah. But then I got to get home and I got to do this, so I can't do that. But it was like in play in a very casual way. As I got a little bit older, it got worse, and I went to a doctor, and I remember a doctor in West Seattle, and I went into his room and I sat down and he said, "You're depressed." I didn't even say a word. And, you know, we talked about it. We talked about all my symptoms and it checked out. So yeah, it's something I've dealt with through medication, through therapy, through exercise and mindfulness. And like a lot of people, I function, I'm happy plenty of the time. But it's a constant assessment and calibration of what I need to do to get to the point where people without this disease naturally are.
As you get happier, do you find you get less funny?
No. I mean, I find that if I'm calibrating it correctly, I'm doing my best work as a writer when I'm in a good place. But when I'm at my lowest, the stuff I write, it's okay. It's funny in a very dark way, but then it just hits those notes of darkness so much. Like, it's like writing a song and you just keep coming back to a D chord over and over and over. Eventually you're gonna be like, do you know an F or a C or something? So yeah, it's, I think that's a big myth with depression, with addiction issues, that like, oh, if I clean up and get healthy, I'm going to lose my edge. I just don't think there's anything to that.
Well, then what is the connection between... Do you mind if I ask you a timeless, unfathomable riddle? And then I want you to answer very concisely.
Sure.
Then what is the connection between funny and depressed?
I think there might be something to the recognition of the chaotic universe. If I may counter your very broad and general question with a dime store trippy philosophical answer.
You one-upped me. Congratulations.
Yeah, exactly. Touché. Something I hear a lot is when that depression hits, you're kind of in touch with the, oh God, what am I doing here? Like, I'm a misfit. I'm not thinking the way other people are. I'm not in the same world that everybody else is. And I think that might give you some fresh eyes into it. I always joke about how I desperately crave the approval of strangers, and that's led me to a career in writing and radio. So while my reasoning is pathological, the result is quite pleasant. Mm-hmm. I get to do a lot of stuff that I like. But I think it's also a draw because our mutual friend Dana Gould was telling me about this.
Hilarious.
Wonderful guy. Hilarious guy. He said that the life of a comedian is ideally suited for depressives because what you get to do is you get to go off on your own and write your own thoughts and stew in yourself for a little while. Then you get to go up and simulate conversation with somebody else in that you do all the talking, they have to listen, you know exactly what you're going to say, and then they approve of you, hopefully.
Sounds like comedy was invented by a depressed person.
And then you go back to your hotel room for the other 23 hours of the day, and just you're left alone with your terrible, terrible thoughts.
Yeah. So you're talking with colleagues about what you do and how you feel, and you're sharing it with us. Why are you doing it? What are you accomplishing?
I mean, the big thing that I'm hoping to do is just get people talking about it and get people to not feel so alone and to not feel like there's something wrong with them if they have had some of these same thoughts that these comics have had and that, you know, that a lot of people have. It's such an insidious disease, depression, because it tries to isolate you. It tries to make you feel like something's deeply wrong and, you know, you should be shut off from the world. So I think we're just trying to make it less scary and make it more commonplace. Bill, I think of it like we as a culture decided in like the 1970s, let's not litter anymore. That's disgusting.
Right.
And littering got a lot better. And then in the 80s, it was like, hey, all this drunk driving is a terrible idea. Let's make that not okay anymore. And let's all get behind that. And we did. And I'd like this to be the next thing where we say, hey, let's, you know, if someone is depressed, if someone is bipolar or has an anxiety disorder, whatever it is, get that worked on. Get that, you know, take your car into the shop if it's making that dinging sound, you know?
That's my friend John Moe, writer, performer, host of a brand new podcast about mental health and comedy. Again, it's called The Hilarious World of Depression. Their first episode, by the way, features Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me host Peter Sagal. You can find it, The Hilarious World of Depression, on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Same place you can get a podcast of this show, The Record, on KUOW Seattle. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us on Twitter at KUOW.